This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Renee Lertzman. Renee is a consultant with climate and environmental organizations focusing on the topics of psychosocial dimensions of climate change, environmental issues, energy, and engagement. She teaches psychology of environmental education and communication at Royal Rose University, British Columbia, and is author of the book, Environmental Melancholia, Psychoanalytic Dimensions of Engagement, and the upcoming The Myth of Apathy. Renee Lertzman is here today to discuss how our emotional response to the climate crisis can hinder productive action and what we can do about it. Welcome, Renee.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
What is at the heart of our lack of an effective response to climate change? What is your view?
Well, my view is that what tends to get in the way or impede what we might expect to see as more of a active way of responding to what's happening is a combination of some incredibly complicated psychological and social issues. And essentially where I'm coming from and what I've learned and seen over the years is that the primary issue that we're looking at is how people can feel overwhelmed and powerless, and combine that with emotions of potential loss, anger, sadness. So we're really looking at, in fact, an incredibly complicated situation that can make it hard for people to know quite how to navigate this most effectively.
What does psychoanalytic work have to offer in addressing climate change?
So I've turned to psychoanalytic research and thinking for many years now. And it's not that I set out to look at this work and, you know, had a particular interest in psychoanalysis for its own sake. What happened was when I was around 18 and 19, I was taking an environmental studies course as a freshman in college at UC Santa Cruz, and I was having quite a profound experience where I was going into these lectures and learning about quite traumatic and intense issues facing our planet and our ecology, and then coming out of those lectures in a bit of a state of shock, and then going into my psychology class. At the time, I was majoring in psychology, and I wasn't finding a whole lot that was helping me make sense of what I was learning about and what I was seeing. And as it happens, I was exposed to psychoanalytic material and readings through a relative of mine who had some books around the house. And what I found is I would open up these books, whether it was Freud or Melanie Klein or a number of more recent psychoanalytic thinkers, and I found that what they were writing about, even though what they were discussing had to do with the personal, internal world, to me, it described almost exactly what we were seeing happening out in the world with regards to environmental issues. So what I was reading about, you know, I would open up the book and I would read about denial. I would read about anxiety and how as humans, we have this enormous capacity to manage our anxiety through a lot of strategies that aren't particularly helpful, but that we've developed out of survival, right? And so these defense mechanisms, I think of them as strategies, so that they're not demonized as good or bad. They're strategies that we have been developing to manage what can feel to be intolerable, whether that is about conflicts it brings up for us, where we have an incredible sense of internal conflict, whether there's issues of loss and mourning and how do we grieve. All of these things I was reading about in the psychoanalytic literature that helped me gain some insight. And I began to see that, in fact, this is an incredible resource that we have and that we're not actually accessing, we're not really tapping into for a number of, I think, understandable reasons. But what psychoanalysis and psychoanalytic psychology has to offer specifically, that the other forms of psychology, whether it's behavioral or cognitive, neuroscience, not to say any of those are limited, but what the psychoanalytic offers us beautifully in relation to environmental issues is precisely the interest in, number one, conflict. So, you know, as we learn about issues, it can arouse and evoke incredible conflicts that we have. It understands the dynamics of unconscious processes, so that we're not necessarily in control at the conscious level, and that, in fact, our unconscious life is often really dominant. And third is an acute interest in understanding precisely in anxiety and how humans manage anxiety. So really, if we look at all of those three, and then in combination with these things, is the attention to, okay, how do we provide the context to support people, whether it's an individual, whether it's a family, whether it's a group, to feel safe enough and to have that sense of what would be called containment, so we can actually look at what's happening and move through towards behavioral changes. You know, so really the end goal is exactly the same. We all want and need behavior change. But really what we're looking at are, what are the resources that support us to design ways to get there most effectively right now? And I do see psychoanalytic work as uniquely powerful in this way, especially in combination with all the other work that we've been developing over the years that's very powerful as well, whether that's technological, social, cultural, political, that it's sort of an ingredient that we can introduce into the mix to make our work so much more effective.
Could you give a specific example for an individual how these emotional states play out when people address climate change issues?
I'm hesitant to say that there's any particular standard way, because it's very personal and very unique for each person what comes up. But what I've seen in my experience, whether doing research, interviews, doing market research, which I do as an applied practitioner, whether I'm working with students, there does seem to be some common things that come up, which have to do with what happens when we become cognizant and aware of the scale of the issues and our own relationship with those issues, which is to say our complicity. The fact that I am, as a being living in this culture and this time right now, I'm participating in practices that I'm now learning about that are causing damage. And so what we see coming up can be a number of strategies, including a sense of guilt and shame. And that's where we look at the internalization. So I don't want to be causing that damage, and I'm therefore part of the problem. So there's the guilt, and then there's the shame, and then there's often a sense of sort of like a overwhelm or powerlessness or helplessness, because, you know, as human beings, we're wired to solve problems. And so when we are learning about a quote-unquote problem at this scale, often the natural response, of course, is to want to solve and fix the problem. But what we're looking at here are issues that are so deeply systemic, right, and so complicated, that that can then bring up an incredible sense of frustration. And some of what I'm talking about is not necessarily on a conscious level. It's more at that experiential level. And so people then can kind of tune out and engage in various what would be called defenses, where we rationalize or intellectualize, well, you know, I'm doing the best I can. I have to focus on my children and supporting the family, and I've got aging parents, or whatever we have going on in our lives. And it becomes a way of kind of negotiating our relationship with what's happening. And that's exactly what I'm most interested in, and what the focus of my book is about, is how people distance themselves from their concern and from their care. So it's not that it's not there. It's that often, because we feel powerless, because we feel overwhelmed, because we're learning now at an unprecedented level about the scale, we're learning about things happening in China and the Arctic and so forth. And so it can easily undercut and short circuit our engagement. And so there's actually a book recently published by Mary Pfeiffer, The Green Boat. It's a wonderful book. And Mary actually provides a narrative of her journey through when she first read a book by Bill McKibben, and she talks about the despair, the anger, frustration, overwhelm. And in her case, she ended up deciding to start a group to do something in her community. And she writes about what that experience does for her way of relating with the issue. So it's not kind of a rah-rah, like a light story in terms of, oh, and then all of a sudden everything was okay. It's more that as a psychotherapist, she's describing, this is how I responded, and this may be of interest for you. So it's hard to say that there's a sequence, right? But there's some predictable responses.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Renee Lertzman, environmental communication consultant, associate faculty at Royal Roads University, British Columbia, and author of Environmental Melancholia, Psychoanalytic Dimensions of Engagement. Our topic is how our emotional response to the climate crisis can hinder productive action and what we can do about it. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. You've been alluding to this, but what do you mean by environmental melancholia?
Well, environmental melancholia is a concept that came to me while I was doing my research for my doctoral work, and I was conducting interviews with people living in Green Bay, Wisconsin. So melancholia, as it was conceived by Freud initially, is really a clinical state that relates to how mourning is processed or not processed, right? How we work through mourning. And what it alludes to is a state of unresolved or unworked through mourning. Not to oversimplify it, it's actually very complicated. But what I was finding in the interviews was a very curious phenomenon where I was hearing people talk about their environment, the water, the Great Lakes, the Fox River in the region, with a sense of loss, with a mood of loss. So there was a real recognition that something is gone, things are no longer what they used to be, but yet that the quality of the loss was sort of not acknowledged. So it's not that people would necessarily say, I am feeling loss about this. It was coming through in the stories. And so what started to stand out to me was the way that with this kind of sense of melancholia and this loss, that people weren't necessarily able to imagine what it would look like to heal and repair and restore these environments. And that's the thing about melancholia, is it's sort of an arrested state. And what I've learned and been very interested in is the relationship between social interaction. So our ability to actually name and talk about loss, which we all know, psychologically we know that mourning happens through when we can talk about it. We can name it. We come together for ceremonies, for memorials, for funerals. We have markers, we have ways of marking loss. But when loss is not talked about and it's not named and we don't even think of it in that way, it tends to go underground and it's not really processed. And so what was coming through to me was the sense that people potentially are not engaging more actively in our environmental issues precisely because there's a profound sense of loss and longing and nostalgia. It's not necessarily at that fully cognitive level, but it's in the experiential level. And when it's not named, it sort of becomes this ongoing state where, well, what can we do about it? So there's a resignation that happens. And so environmental melancholia is a way of naming and describing a phenomenon. So the environmental melancholia is a way of really trying to give a name to a phenomenon and to help us shift our focus from do people care or not about what's going on in the environment to, well, what else might be going on that could make it hard for people to actually engage and connect with their feelings about what's going on.
Would you also amplify your ideas about the myth of apathy, which you've just started alluding to?
Mm-hmm. So the myth of apathy, again, came to me while I was doing my research. And what it's about fundamentally is really exploding this idea that if people are not engaging, responding, behaving, and acting in particular ways, they are apathetic, and therefore the apathy is a lack of, right? So the term apathy, literally, it refers to a lack of pathos, right? A lack of feeling. And what we know from psychodynamic and psychoanalytic psychology is that apathy is best understood as a defense mechanism. It's how we cope. It's how we manage. And so the myth of apathy is to shift our attention from focusing on apathy as a thing. Apathy was coined in the 1940s. The term public apathy first appeared in the early 1940s in relation to public marketing, right? So when we were first starting to put out messaging at that public level, whether it's about engaging in politics or whatever, and the lack of response was labeled as public apathy. And so rather than looking at, well, what might we be doing not particularly well, it was labeling it and placing it in the public as if there was something wrong with the public, and that is apathy. And so the myth of apathy is really wanting to shake that up and to suggest that, in fact, it's not that there's a lack, that there could be actually a surplus of emotional stuff going on for people that shows up as a lack of care. I know it sounds very paradoxical, but that's what I think we're looking at.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Renee Lertzman, environmental communication consultant, associate faculty at Royal Rose University, British Columbia, and author of Environmental Melancholia. Our topic is how our emotional response to the climate crisis can hinder productive action and what we can do about it. So what steps can we take to get around these emotional states and allow for more productive action in regard to climate change?
Well, I think that there's a few things that we can do right away. One is, and this is something I've written about a bit, is breaking the taboo around talking about and acknowledging our emotional responses to what's happening. So it's actually very simple. I don't think that what we need is complicated, but I don't think it's easy, right? But it's simple. So breaking the taboo means being able to begin talking about in a very kind of natural way, whether you're an educator or working in an organization and in a leadership position or talking with your family members. But it's about basically saying, this is how I'm feeling right now, and like breaking that taboo, which gives other people the permission to sort of go there. So that's one thing. Related to this is recognizing the power and importance of groups. And when people are in a group or social situation, it can provide much more of a sense of safety to actually look at what's happening. So, for example, there's a project in the UK that has been quite inspiring for me called Carbon Conversations. And I think the Carbon Conversations model, which is a group meets over 6 meetings and they use a workbook, and it's basically how do we reduce our carbon footprint. But it was developed by a psychoanalytic psychologist in the UK, Rosemary Randall, and she recognizes that, you know, when people get together in groups, a lot of things can happen a lot more quickly. And it provides that kind of support, even if it's not explicitly about let's all process and have group therapy at all. It really can be at a very mundane level, seeing what happens when we connect with neighbors and people in our communities. And that relates to the third piece, which is bringing in, you know, the reason I'm interested in applying the psychoanalytic and the psychodynamic is that I believe that it helps us bring into the ways that we communicate and relate with ourselves and one another with more compassion and more understanding of how easy it can be to be triggered emotionally. These are very scary, very distressing issues, very upsetting, very. And so I think that we tend to kind of skirt on the surface of that. And it's very scary to actually look at how hard it is. And I think the only way we can go into this more effectively is to think collectively about how we can bring in element of compassion. And I talked about this recently at Town Hall. What does that look like? You know, it doesn't mean being namby-pamby and kind of, oh, it's all okay, and, you know, letting everyone off the hook. Actually, operating with compassion can have a real fierceness to it. It can be a warrior mode of operating. But it's an effective, skillful warrior mode because we're recognizing that when people are scared and anxious, we do tend to regress and we do tend to not necessarily be our best selves. And that's what I see playing out with the polarization and the way people can get very kind of fixated and locked into particular positions. We're trying to protect ourselves. So anything that we can do to bring in some recognition. And I have a tool that I use with groups and organizations called the 3 A's. And it's a way to distill this way of thinking about this work along the lines of, if we recognize that there's anxiety, A, number one, there's ambivalence. So often mixed feelings and conflicts can come up for people in relation to what it means to kind of cope with these issues, ambivalence. And there's aspiration, which is our fundamental need as human beings to be part of something bigger, to experience ourselves as creative and having agency and having impact and having efficacy. And in order to get to that A, we really do need to be able to acknowledge the other A's, to say, this is hard and scary. What's it like for you? If you're designing a climate campaign, it's absolutely essential to understand what your audience might be feeling anxious about, what might be feeling ambivalent about, and then acknowledging that, which is something I don't see happening, which is to say, yeah, join our project, our campaign, our initiative, and we know that this can be hard, and we know that maybe part of you is feeling a little mixed about it. It's amazing what can happen when we just simply acknowledge what the experience might be for other people.
Do you have some specific success stories using these approaches?
There are success stories. So one of the areas I've been working in more recently is in the energy efficiency sector. That's a place where we really do need to be shifting behaviors radically and quickly. And so I've worked with a few governmental agencies, private sector companies that are working on how do we shift our behaviors to be more tuned into energy efficiency. And so what I do is I will go out and do interviews, focus groups, some secondary research. But really what I'm interested in and what I'm listening to is, what does this mean for you in your life? What does this bring up? What do you associate with this whole concept of efficiency? How do you relate with energy in your life? And going from that place of understanding what this is like in our lives, and then working with these organizations to craft messaging that is more human. It's more at that human level where we can say, you know, we get it that when you're at home, for example, being at home is really about feeling safe and secure and comfortable. And then moving in from that angle into how our relationship with energy fits in with that and how we can relate with the efficiency in a way that feels more in line with what we're needing and wanting, if that makes sense. And so I've worked on some campaigns that have been quite successful that come at this from that angle. The other project that I've been very excited about working with is with the Alliance for Climate Education, which is an organization that works with high school students around the country. This is a fantastic organization that leads assemblies around the U.S. And what they're interested in doing is inspiring and mobilizing young people to become more active and advocates. And one of the projects I've worked with them on is designing what I call learning labs or climate psychology labs, where we do these trainings around how to talk with people more effectively about climate change in a way that's going to be constructive and not lead into a bad situation where people feel defensive. And applying insights from motivational interviewing, which is a really powerful resource that's starting to be looked at more and more as a tool, how we can train young people to have these conversations. And what I found from those trainings, these labs, is that the students feel so much more empowered and so much more confident because they're going into these interactions without feeling like they have to persuade someone else. It's really about listening, and it's about paying attention to where other people are and asking questions to draw out people in a way where it's almost like we're able to find our own way. Would you consider doing this? Would you be open to doing that? It's sort of like guiding versus writing, which is to say, you should do this. And if you cared more about the environment, you would be doing this, which puts everyone on the defensive.
Overall, what kind of response are you getting to your ideas about using a more psychoanalytic approach to addressing climate change?
What I'm finding is that there's enormous interest, actually, and a lot of curiosity. And what I find is that what I'm saying sort of resonates for people on a intuitive level. And so I'm just giving expression to what I think is sort of intuitive. I find that there's more challenge in engaging with this work from, paradoxically, the climate campaigning community, because it's so tactically oriented. And what I'm talking about is, in fact, tactical, but it's how we think about our tactics. And I think whenever there's something new that's coming along, it's going to be hard for people to sort of get their minds around, and that's okay. But I'm finding that younger people, people working in education, are really resonating. And there's some sectors that I think are finding it harder to go there. The other thing is, I think that there is such an incredible sense of urgency, which there is urgency, that it can sort of short circuit our abilities to be more open to looking at different ways of looking at this. But on the whole, I feel like it's incredibly positive. And yeah, I'm really feeling encouraged by how the work is starting to develop.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I would say the message is to always keep in mind that climate change and environmental issues are profoundly complicated and distressing for all of us, that no one intended for this to happen. These are what could be thought of as unintended consequences, that we are now seeing these consequences at a massive scale, and that it's helpful to think about environmental awareness or climate awareness as traumatic, and that we have resources available to us to bring in a truly integrative and compassionate and ultimately far more effective way of engaging and communicating with people if we lead with that recognition that this is hard. And then I guess the other thing I would say is that I would love to see more active collaboration and partnership with those who are working on environmental and climate issues, with those who are coming from these more psychological orientations. I think that that's where the work will really start to take off, that it's not about one or the other. It's really about the ability that we have to collaborate and innovate how we're engaging and communicating with people.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Renee.
Thank you so much for having me.
You were just listening to Renee Lertzman, Environmental Communications Consultant, Associate Faculty at Royal Road University, British Columbia, and author of Environmental Melancholia. For more information, check on the web at reneelertzman.com. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.